Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to The Rose. Rose Colombo right here just for you.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
That's right. Listen up because we have a wonderful show for you today. And you should be very excited because today we have an honorable guest, and he is a Holocaust survivor. His name is Dr. Jacob Eisenbach. That's E-I-S-E-N-B, like boy, A-C-H. Dr. Jacob Eisenbach. And you want to listen very closely because Dr. Eisenbach has a fascinating and terrifying story of how Dr. Eisenbach, a starving prisoner, and his brother, who built weapons at a labor camp in his native Poland during World War II, and how he survived. Very, very intriguing and historical interview you will not want to miss. And also, it is a timely interview to have Dr. Eisenbach on Colombo Chronicles today. Because for the first time in United States history, unprecedented, the state governors have the country locked down, unprecedented in American history, and the entire world on the advice of Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx, and Bill and Melinda Gates, who are billionaires. And it's very frightening for the American people to be locked down and to be denied the right to leave their homes except under specific reasons called essentials, and also to have their freedom, liberty, and rights denied, and to be threatened with a knock on the door and possibly by force tested or vaccinated. And if you resist, the possibility of being forced and taken away from your family. And also there is articles that suggest that if a parent has COVID-19, that they can take your children away. This is very concerning to the American people. So this interview is very, very timely. And also, we want our young people to remember the Holocaust and the story about the genocide that occurred during World War II. We want that to be remembered throughout history, not just yesterday and today, but in the future, because we never, ever want it to happen again. He survived horrible things when what the Nazis did in the 1940s and during World War II, not only to killing 6 million Jews, but to killing other minority groups, even gays. So we're in a very strange and concerning time in history right now. So let me tell you a little bit about our guest today. The story of Dr. Jacob Eisenbach begins with a loving childhood, soon dashed and swept into a world of sorrow from the horrors of the Holocaust. His inspirational tale of survival, hope, faith, and love would come to shape his sense of purpose in his life to come. His experience would bestow upon him his greatest mission, which is to prevent future genocides and inspire new generations with his profound kindness and humanity. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about Dr. Jacob Eisenbach in just a little bit. But first, I wanted to mention to you some stories that were also concerning that are happening right now in our country. And there is a story that is about the next coronavirus tyranny, which is about forced vaccinations and digital vaccination certificates, that if you do not have the certificate with you, probably published by, developed and created by Microsoft, Bill Gates' company, you can't leave home without it. You can't work. You can't buy or sell. You can't open your business. You can't operate your business. You can't travel. You can't drive. So this is very, very concerning, because people should be asking, how is this constitutional? How is a tracking device constitutionally legal and lawful if it is not in accordance with the United States Constitution and the will of the majority of the American people? There's another article that talks about Dr. Fauci and how he backed the controversial Wuhan lab with U.S. tax dollars in the millions for the risky coronavirus research in Wuhan, China. That is very concerning to me and to the majority of Americans, and we need to call our representatives and ask questions. And that number is 202-225-3121. You can email your reps, you can call your reps, you can write your reps, but you need to be proactive so that we can restore our constitutional freedom, liberty, and rights right here in our own homeland. So on that note, we're going to enter into the world of authors and experts with our very special guest, Dr. Jacob Eisenbach, right after this important message. So don't touch that dial. The Rose will be right back with you in just a moment.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Colombo Chronicles Live with The Rose every Wednesday, noon to 1 p.m., with very special guests, authors, and experts from around the world. And today we have a very special expert and an international speaker and the honor of speaking to one of the few Holocaust survivors, and who also speaks on the Holocaust and genocide at universities and schools, and invites by politicians and high-profile people around the world, because that is his mission. Dr. Jacob Eisenbach was born in 1923 in Lodz, Poland. He is a Holocaust survivor. After the war, he emigrated to the United States with his family in 1950. He practiced dentistry for 60 years until he retired at the age of 92 in 2015. He speaks about his astonishing life while in the grip of Hitler's Third Reich, and how hatred, discrimination, and intolerance led directly to the Jewish Holocaust. He is the sole survivor of a loving family reaching 100. Torture and mass murder of numerous ethnic groups over thousands of years have scarred mankind's history. It has been and continues to be Dr. Eisenbach's mission to eliminate the scourge of all genocides from the human race. There is a wonderful book that was written about Dr. Eisenbach and his history, Where You Go, I Go. A boy and his younger brother take on the Third Reich, and one survived. So let's welcome our honored guest, Dr. Jacob Eisenbach, and let's hear more about his story. Welcome, Dr. Eisenbach. We're so happy to have you on Colombo Chronicles today.
Thank you very much for inviting me to your radio show, Rose. I was looking forward to being here and tell you my story.
I am so excited to have you on the show today, because this is such an important part of world history, and it should be not only from the past and today, but also remembered in the future, because this could happen to any country or the world. So you survived the horrible things that the Nazis did in the 1940s, and we only read about, but you are one of the few survivors, and you're to be commended for all the hard work you do on your mission and all the lectures and telling your story. So in World War II, not only did Hitler order his army to kill 6 million Jews, and he killed other minority groups as well. So let's start with your childhood. Can you tell us, I know you were born in the city of Lodz, Poland, and you grew up there. So can you tell us about your childhood and your family?
Absolutely. Rose, tell me how much time do I have to speak?
You can just keep speaking and I'll let you know. Don't worry about it.
Because I can plan my speech according to the length of time I have.
You have...
Is it half hour, 45
minutes? 45 minutes is good.
Okay, very good. Well, to answer your question about my childhood, I was very fortunate to grow up in a loving family. My parents adored each other, and they adored their four children. I had two younger brothers. Sam was 2 years younger. Henry was 5 years younger. And my older sister, Fela, was 3 years older. And we had an extended family of about 100 people. Very loving family. My father was a successful businessman, not on a really big scale, but he employed about 30 people, and he was a very, very good provider. And every summer, he would rent a house from a farmer, a resort place, and the farmer would come out with a horse-drawn wagon and load up all our belongings that we would need for the entire summer. And us four kids were sitting on top of that wagon, and we had a great time. I was a high school student when the war broke out. I was 16. And The resort place was only 10 miles out of town, out of the city of Lodz, my hometown, but it took the horse a whole day to get there. We spent the whole summer there, and we made new friends, played a lot of soccer, bicycle riding, swimming, all kinds of activities that people my age were doing. And my mother was an excellent cook. Whenever I speak of my mother, I like to say that she was not human. She was an angel in a human body.
Oh.
She would gather her four children, put her arms around us, and bless us by saying, "You are my greatest possession." My mother did not go through the Holocaust. She died 1 year before the war at the age of 41. I was 15 at the time. She had a problem with heart valves. She had rheumatic fever during childhood that affected her heart valves. And in those days, the medical profession did not have a solution for this problem.
My gosh, you actually lost your mother at a very when you were very young then, and so
yeah.
How did your father cope with that, being a single father?
Well, it was a terrible shock because she was just adored by my father, and my mother had a sister, and he asked my mother's sister to take care of us children, and she did. And,
so after your mother passed away, how soon then did the Nazis invade Poland?
The Nazis invaded Poland on September 1st, 1939. Before that, in June of 1939, there was a German ship called the St. Louis, which arrived at the shores of the United States asking for asylum for 947 Jewish passengers who were escaping from the murderous grip of the Nazis. That asylum was denied. The ship had to turn back and go back to Europe, and many of those refugees were caught by the Nazis and they were murdered. Who was responsible for that decision not to allow these refugees asylum? It was Cordell Hull, who was the American Secretary of State for 12 years. And he was telling President Roosevelt that we cannot allow these people to enter the United States because they do not have return addresses. Preposterous. How could you turn away people who are running away from deadly murderers not to enter the United States?
You actually put a different light on asylum seekers right now, because I don't think Americans, you know, who were born here really think about that as you just presented it. And so it does put a different light on it and more empathy towards the refugees seeking tyranny. Thank you.
Right. And power in 1933, and shortly after he came to power, he started arming Germany. He was preparing for war. He had an air force. He had tanks. He had trucks, motorcycles, ammunition, armaments. He had everything he needed. 1 week before the outbreak of the war, he signed a treaty with Joseph Stalin, the president of the Soviet Union. They decided to divide Poland and not to interfere with each other's activities. The war broke out on September 1st, 1939, and a few days after that, within 7 days, they entered the city of Lodz, my hometown. And a short time after they entered, they took the old part of the city and started building a wrought iron fence around that part of the city, and that was to be the ghetto of Lodz. A ghetto is a place where Jewish people live.
And
they issued an order that every Jew must enter the ghetto before May 1st, 1940. On that day, the ghetto will be hermetically locked up. And any Jew found outside the ghetto after that date will be shot to death on the spot. Before, the ghetto was hermetically sealed off. People from Lodz escaped from the Nazi-occupied part of Poland to the Russian part of Poland. Among those people who escaped was my sister Fela. She just graduated from high school and was admitted to a university to study pharmacology, but her plans did not realize because of the war. And she and a few of her girlfriends escaped to the Russian part of Poland, and she settled in the city of Lwów, L-W-O-W. And we lost complete contact with her after May 1st, 1940. After the war, I met a lady who came from the city of Lwów, where my sister was. When the Nazis occupied the eastern part of Poland 2 years after the war broke out, because Hitler broke the non-aggression pact with Stalin and attacked the Soviet Union against the advice of his top politicians and generals. They told him not to do it because he will not be able to supply the front lines in that brutal Russian winter of 50, 60 below zero and 5-6 feet of snow. But Hitler was under the influence of amphetamines. His judgment was impaired, and he made one of the biggest mistakes that he has ever made. He disregarded and didn't listen to the advice of his top advisors and broke the non-aggression pact with Joseph Stalin and attacked the Soviet Union. He couldn't supply the front lines in the wintertime. The advisors were telling him that Napoleon tried that in 1812, and he failed miserably for that very reason. He couldn't supply the front lines. As a result of that, he lost about 1 million soldiers on the Russian front, and he started retreating from the Eastern Front. The Allies attacked in Normandy, and they were retreating from Normandy. So he was losing on both the Eastern and the Western Front. And I remained in the ghetto. And while I was in that ghetto, they shipped out all of my extended family to guest chambers. Those people were told that they're going to other camps for labor, but that was a big lie. We found out from the Polish train conductors that they're taking these people to places like Auschwitz, Majdanek, and Treblinka, where they had guest chambers, and no one ever comes out alive. And they could smell burning flesh in the air, because after getting those people, they burned their bodies. So we knew what they were doing with the Jews.
Ghetto. So were you with your brother then, or was it just you?
I was met by my brother Sam, and my father, and my youngest brother Henry, at the age of 11, in the ghetto. When they locked up the ghetto, they were in full control of the food supplies and just gave us enough food so we don't die from starvation. But I saw many, many people die from starvation in the streets of the ghetto. In addition
and
to starvation, we had...
I'm going to say, and dying from starvation, a lot of people don't realize how painful it is to die of starvation and thirst, right?
Oh,
we saw it firsthand.
That's horrible. That's horrible. What happened is because of starvation, because of lack of protein, they developed swellings in their ankles. That swelling moved up their legs and up to their body. And when it reached the heart, you just dropped dead. family. So my brother, we had a typhus epidemic in addition to starvation. And my brother Henry was 11 years old at the time. And he developed a high fever. We had our own Jewish doctors in the ghetto, and we had two hospitals which were included in that ghetto. And we called the doctor. He diagnosed him with typhus and told us to take him to a hospital, so we did. The next day, I had a little job there in the ghetto. On my way to my work, I was walking. I was passing one of the two hospitals, but it wasn't the one where my brother was. And what do I see? A big truck, the kind of truck that's used to transport cattle with spaces between the boards, being loaded with patients from the hospital and guarded by Nazis with machine guns. And they loaded these patients, live people, 30 layers on top of each other. When I saw that, I started running to the other hospital where I placed my brother the day before. It was 3 miles. And I kept running. On the way, I came across another truck like this, just like it. And that truck was moving away from that other hospital. So I stopped for a moment. The streets were deserted. And I stopped to look between the bars to see if I can spot Henry, but I couldn't. I didn't see him. The driver had a companion soldier in the driver's compartment, and he had a machine gun. And when he saw me watching the truck, he started shooting at me. But his bullets did not reach me because I was in the front of an apartment building, and I ran out into the building. And that truck continued away from the hospital, and I continued running toward the hospital. And when I got there, I saw a third truck in front of the hospital being loaded with patients. The hospital compound was surrounded by an 8-foot fence. You couldn't get in. So I went to the back of the hospital, and there was a crowd of people on the outside of the fence, and nurses were turning patients over to that crowd of people to save them from the Nazis. I climbed that fence. To this day, I didn't know how I was able to climb an 8-foot fence on 5'4". But I did, and I went to the room where I put my brother in the day before, and he was not there. I asked the nurses, where is Henry? He was taken out 15 minutes ago. He was in that truck that I came across in the street.
Oh, my God.
And I have never seen Henry again.
And oh, these so people, sorry.
All of these patients from both hospitals were taken straight to Auschwitz, and they were gassed the day they arrived. And I have never seen Henry again.
That is heart-wrenching.
And we found out from the lady from Lvov after the war, I met her in Lodz. She was in the ghetto of Lvov after the Nazis broke the non-aggression pact with Stalin and occupied the city of Lodz. And they built a ghetto that occupied the city of Lvov. And that's where my sister was. And she told me what happened in that ghetto. There were 110,000 Jews in the ghetto of the city of Lvov. And one day, the Nazis came with machine guns and killed all 110,000 of the Jewish people in the ghetto of Lvov in 3 days.
And
I have never seen my sister Fela again. So I was left in the ghetto with my father and my brother Sam, 2 years younger. One day my father receives an order to report for deportation with 600 men. And he was a businessman. He never worked physically. And I didn't know what happened to him. But I found out after the war. I met a man who was in that group of 600 that they took out of the ghetto. And he told me what the Nazis did to those people. They had them carry heavy rocks from place to place on a starvation diet. And they all died out from hard labor and starvation. And I have never seen my father again. That leaves me and Sam my brother Sam. One day, I received an order to report for deportation. That was a death sentence. I knew where I'm going. I'm going to Auschwitz, to the gas chambers. We lived in a one-room place upstairs with creaking wooden steps. And we took, when I got the order to report, we took everything out of the room, put a padlock on the door. Neighbors were telling us that the police was there a number of times. And when they saw the padlock, they walked away. I was the only one who got the order to report for deportation. My brother Sam did not. So we went into hiding. We did not report for deportation. And we managed to hide for a month. And after we ran out of places to hide, we decided to go back to that room upstairs. The room was completely empty. We put a pile of straw in the corner, and Sam and I laid down in the pile of straw, and a friend of ours put the padlock on the outside. One night, at midnight, we hear heavy footsteps on those creaking wooden steps with loud voices. It's the police. They are coming for me, not for Sam. So one of those two policemen said to the other, he had a flashlight, there's a padlock here. There's nobody here. Let's go. But the other policeman was a wise guy, and he says, no, let's not go. Let's knock off the padlock and look inside and see what's going on. So they went downstairs, came back in a few minutes with a crowbar, knocked off the padlock, and opened the door. And the first policeman with the flashlight said to the other one, well, the room is empty. There's nobody here. Let's go. And the other guy says, no, let's not go. Let's look at a pile of straw and see what's in there. So they uncovered us. And they were all after me, not my brother. And I know that this is my end. That I know exactly where I'm going. I'm going to Auschwitz, to the gas chambers. My brother Sam could have said to me, Jack, I know where you are going. I'm not going with you. I'll stay right here. But this is not what Sam said. What he did say is, Jack, our whole family is now gone. Now they are taking you away. I am not staying here by myself. I'm going with you. Wherever you go, I go. And whatever happens to you will happen to me. And he knew exactly what's going to happen to him, namely the gas chamber. And he goes with me. That's the kind of a bond we had in our family.
Gosh.
They loaded us on trains for 3 days and three nights. Finally, the train stops, and we were sure we were in Auschwitz, and we were. But they did not unload us there. The train conductor suddenly got orders to change directions. We were at the doorstep of the gas chambers, but we never entered the camp of Auschwitz. Instead, they took us to a munition factory. After they lost 1 million soldiers on the Eastern Front, they took the German people out of the war production to replace the dead soldiers. And they decided those young Jews who are still able to work, we'll put them to work in our war production. And they took us to a munition factory. That munition factory was in the city of Skarżysko, about 70 miles from my hometown Lodz. Adjoining that factory was a concentration camp, like the ghetto, with the barbed wire fence and Nazi soldiers on watchtowers with machine guns and searchlights. You couldn't escape. And there were 6,000 Jews in that camp. And some of the people were assigned to Department A, That included me and my brother and a few of our friends. Other people were assigned to another department, which was a deadly department. And I met my future wife in a most romantic place in a Nazi concentration camp. That was in that camp in Skarżysko.
Oh, my gosh.
After,
oh, my gosh.
After,
I'm looking at this in my head and visualizing it. And, I mean, I cannot put myself in your shoes, but I'm trying to visualize this. And in some ways I'm seeing, you know, that God helped. At least you're with your brother and you met your wife. And now you're on a mission. And so I'm trying to get the positive things, too, that came out of such a Holocaust and genocide. I mean, it's very hard to hear. It's very, very hard to hear. And I thank you so much.
Well, I'm getting to the positive aspect of my speech.
God. Keep going.
We were in that camp in Skarżysko for 3 months. And the Eastern Front was getting closer and closer, and we could hear artillery shots. And the Nazis decided to move the munition factory from Skarżysko to the city of Częstochowa in Poland, which was closer to Germany and farther away from the front. So they took us out there, and we had to move the heavy machines. I was working on a precision grinding machine, which weighed about 2-3 tons. And we were forced to move those machines on wooden rollers. One of my buddies, my best friend, fell on the one of those machines and broke a leg. And he was screaming in excruciating pain. And a Nazi soldier came along, pulled out his gun, and put a bullet in his head.
Oh.
And he silenced him. He was not about to help a sick Jew.
Wow.
And my friend died. I shed tears on January 15th. Yes, Rose?
Do you think that these Nazi soldiers wanted to shoot everyone, or do you think they feared for their own lives and had no choice, or they would be shot?
Well, let me tell you about it. That's an excellent question. Hitler did not trust very much the German army, the Wehrmacht. So he organized his own personal army of volunteers. And these people were volunteering for persecuting and murdering Jews. They knew exactly what they are volunteering for. And their leader,
wow,
General Heinrich Himmler, told them, he was indoctrinated them, persecute and kill Jews without mercy. And they did. They were volunteers. And they wanted,
wow,
to do that.
Now, okay,
the question was, at one point I was asked the question, how come Hitler hated the Jews so much? I did some research, and I found a book with Hitler's speeches. And in one of those speeches, this is what he said, and I quote, "Providence has ordained that I become the greatest liberator of mankind. Ancient and outdated ideas of justice and morality. And those ideas were brought to the world by the Jews, and they are in my way, and that's why I have to eliminate them." That's why he was killing the Jews. He wanted a world without justice, a world without morality. How would anybody want to live in a world like that?
Obviously, psychopath.
Absolutely. He was diagnosed as suffering from paranoia. He was blaming others for his own failures.
Mm-hmm.
On January 15th, 19th, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I don't think you hate anyone from what you know. From
I don't
what
hate
you're
anybody,
saying.
No.
I don't know. So, but do you ever feel like you've forgiven them, or you know how people say you have to forgive? Do you believe that you've forgiven those people?
Excellent question. Excellent question. Those people committed the greatest crimes in human history. And the Torah is teaching us that those people who shed our blood should not be forgiven. If we forgive them, we would give them permission. That's equivalent to giving them permission to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And we cannot.
I agree with that.
And there's a book written by the former American Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, co-authored by William Cohen, was the former American Secretary of Defense. They co-authored the book entitled Preventing Genocides. And they presented an international plan to prevent genocides. And my mission is the advancing the international crusade against all genocides, not only against Jews, because genocides have been carried out against all kinds of religions, nations, and nationalities. And they still happen to this day.
And it can happen again if people aren't aware of the history of the Holocaust that happened in Europe. And as a child, when you're being put through the most horrific, terrorizing event in history, what was going through your head, and how was it just survival and just trying to stay alive? What was going through your head as a child?
Okay. Ever since I was 5 years old, I just loved, our house was always had friends and relatives, visitors. And I just loved to sit in and listen to adult conversations. And I learned many lessons which served me well throughout my life. But if I have to pick up one lesson that is the most important one, and that is, no matter how dark the clouds may be, there will always be a day when the sun will break through. Translated, it means never lose hope for a better day. I faced death in the ghetto, starvation, typhus. And I always kept that in mind. I was seeing people around me dying, but I always kept that in mind, never give up that hope for a better day.
I like that.
That kept me going.
And then going back to the camp where your friend was shot, what happened after that? You saw that happen, and now you lost your good friend. What happened after that?
Okay. On January 15th, 1945, Chernyshov was surrounded by barbed wire and watchtowers with soldiers with machine guns. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, the armed guards disappeared from these towers with the machine guns. First time in 5 years, never happened before. We couldn't believe it. Our Jewish leader was telling us, don't walk out of the camp in the middle of the night because bullets and shrapnels are flying in the streets of Chernyshov. So we listened to that advice. But the next morning, on January 16, 1945, woke out of the camp That was me, my brother Sam, and my girlfriend Irene. Three, I enrolled at the University of Lodz. My brother Sam joins the Polish Army within 2 years. He obtained the rank of colonel in the Polish Army, one rank under a general at the age of 22, in charge of a division of 10,000 soldiers. Unheard of. Absolutely
amazing.
Unheard of.
It's
for
amazing.
A 22-year-old to obtain such a high rank.
Absolutely.
2 years after the war, there was a lot of anti-Semitism in Poland, but there were a lot of great Polish humanitarians as well. And one day, the army decided to send them from the city of Lwów to the city of Białystok, which was known to be very anti-Semitic. So Sam, before he goes to Białystok, he changed his name from Sam Eisenbach to Stanisław Adamowski, as Polish as you can get it. And he goes to Białystok. And he had a similar job in Białystok. And one day, he came home from his office, and somebody, an anti-Semite, was already waiting for him inside his home. And as soon as he came in, he put a bullet in his head and he killed him. 2 years after the war, he found out that Stanisław Adamowski is a Jew. And he killed him because he hated the Jewish people. And the police was so anti-Semitic, they refused to investigate who did that.
Oh, my gosh.
I lost my brother Sam.
That must have been.
Now I'm the only survivor.
That must have really, though, now that you're the only survivor, did you just lose hope, or how did you accept that? I mean, you've lost everybody now except your girlfriend. How did you, I know you have that light of hope, but now you lost the brother you're so close to and so proud of. Did you just say, I have to move on?
I decided that I'm not going to give the Nazis another victory by poisoning my life with depression.
Okay.
We got married in December of 1945, a few months after the war. And after that, a year after the war ended, that was in April of 1946, in the city of Kielce. The anti-Semites came out with crowbars into the city and killed 43 of the few Jewish survivors of the Holocaust. They killed them in the streets of the city.
Oh my gosh.
And my wife and I decided we're not staying here. We are leaving Poland. But we couldn't go because Poland was occupied by the Russians, the communist government. And their policy was not to allow any of their people out of the country because they didn't want them to see how people live in free societies. So they wouldn't let us out. That was in 1946, 2 years before Israel was created. But there was a Jewish organization in Israel called Bricha. Not in Israel, it wasn't Israel yet, it was Palestine. Bricha in Hebrew means escape. Bricha came to Poland and took us out of Poland through the border in the middle of the night into Czechoslovakia. And I don't have enough words to praise the Czech people. They received us wonderfully. They treated us very, very well. They were ordered to check our backpacks, but they didn't even check our backpacks. They had beautiful tables with food, and they had elegant passenger trains waiting for us, and they told us they'll take us any place you want to go in the world.
Oh, my gosh.
So we
there was a light at the end of the tunnel. There was hope. There was a light.
Right.
Just like
there
you said.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I also like to say that there is a light at the present time with COVID-19. Will develop a vaccine, and the coronavirus will be defeated. We have to keep that hope. I'm convinced that we'll defeat the coronavirus.
Oh, thank you. I believe that too. And we just have to stay united, and we have to listen to heroes and honorable men like Dr. Jacob Eisenbach, who is an international lecturer. He's lectured all over the world, universities, colleges, everywhere. And it's so important to keep this going. And I am so thrilled. I learned a lot. I felt the pain. I mean, not to the extent, you know, of people who were there. I feel the pain.
Thank you, Rose.
Sorry.
So I want to continue with a better part.
No, go ahead, because it really did touch me.
More positive part.
Okay.
After we left Poland in 1946, we moved to the American occupied part of Germany, and we settled in the city of Frankfurt am Main. And I enrolled at the University of Frankfurt in the College of Dentistry. It took me 4 years to get my Doctor of Dental Medicine degree. And after I got my degree, we came to the United States under the auspices of the Displaced Immigration Act, which was established by President Truman. So we settled in Frankfurt. I enrolled at the University of Frankfurt in the College of Dentistry, and after 4 years, I received my degree and we came to the United States.
How did you feel when you saw the Statue of Liberty?
Oh, I felt absolutely elated. Ever, you know, throughout my life, my childhood, whenever the conversation came up about the United States, it's the most wonderful country in the world. And I feel that we have a lot of difficulties now, but this is still the most wonderful country in the world. I was asked once a question by somebody. He gets up after my speech and asks the question. He says that some of his friends believe that the United States is going downhill, and some of his friends moved out to other countries, and he's planning to do the same thing. And he asked me my opinion. And I told him, my opinion is that this has always been the greatest country in the world to live in. It still is the greatest country in the world to live in spite of our problems, and it's going to continue to be the greatest country in the world to live in. And after I said that, he said, if that's your opinion, I'm not going anyplace. I'm staying right here.
That's amazing.
So,
And you also, I read that you are working on a documentary too, which is really exciting. This definitely needs to be a documentary, no doubt in my mind.
Yes, this documentary will be a wonderful documentary, and I plan to distribute it all over the world. It will be available for sale pretty soon through my website. And my website is www.thestarofjacob.com. So in the near future.
Oh, good. And you'll let us know when that happens, because definitely want to get
that.
You have a YouTube videos, right?
Yes. I have a channel on YouTube in my name where several of my speeches are recorded. And those people who are interested, I would recommend that you listen to my speech at Cypress College about 2-3 years ago. That was a great speech. There were a lot of people there, about 1,100 people. And the president of the college made a real big production out of it. You'll enjoy listening to it. So we came to the United States, and the law here was that any dentist who has a foreign degree cannot practice here. You have to obtain an American dental degree. So I went to the University of Iowa. It was almost impossible to get into a dental school. There were 1,000 applicants for each opening. And there was a new dean taking over. I had a session with him, about 15, 20-minute session. And he and the chief of staff of the faculty, Dr. Erling Thorn, decided that they'll admit me on the spot. And I was admitted right away. I wanted to start in September, but they wanted me to start right away. Anyway, after 2 years, I was admitted with advanced standing because I already had a degree. And after 2 years, I got my American degree, which was DDS. And that was in 1955. And most of these years, 45 years, I was practicing in Anaheim Hills, California, in your neighborhood, Rose. And I live in Villa Park.
My goodness. You're just around the corner. I'm in Huntington Beach, yeah.
I almost opened my practice in Huntington Beach. I like that town. But for various reasons,
really nice.
I chose Anaheim Hills. And I looked for a place to live, which was not too far away. And that's why we bought this house here that I'm living to this day. Now,
let
me get to the positive aspect.
Okay.
During my speeches, I was also speaking at the New York College of Medicine and New York Touro College of Dental Medicine. And the dean of the College of Dentistry at Touro offered me the title Professor of Dentistry and asked me if I would like to teach there. And this is what my answer was. Thank you very much for your offer. I'm honored by your offer. However, since I retired from the practice of dentistry, I'm devoting my life to speaking about the experiences that I went through and advancing the international crusade against all genocides. This is very important to me because I lost all my family in a genocide. And for that reason, I thank you very much for your offer, but I cannot accept it. I was also offered the professorship of dentistry at the College of Dentistry, University of Iowa, by Dr. David Johnson. He's Danish, and he also offered me a teaching position, and I gave him the same answer. I want to tell you something about people were asking me, did you lose faith in humanity? And my answer was, the king of Denmark, when Denmark was occupied by the Nazis ordered the Jewish people of Denmark to put on yellow stars on the outer clothing so they could identify them in the streets and round them up and send them to gas chambers. And the king of Denmark said to Hitler, if this is what you are going to do to our Jewish citizens, I am going to put on a yellow star. My whole family would put on yellow stars, and every day in the country would put on yellow stars, and you will not be able to tell who is Jewish and who is not. But then he was concerned that the Nazis may come up with other ways to identify the Jews. So he put them on fishing boats and sent all the Danish Jews to neutral Sweden where Hitler could not reach them. And all of the Danish Jews survived the war in Sweden.
My goodness.
And the dean of the College of Dentistry at the University of Iowa is Danish, of Danish descent. And he had a cousin who was working on passports to ship the Danish Jews to Sweden, passports from Sweden. There was a man who was a Japanese diplomat in Lithuania. His name was Chiyoni Sugihara. And he couldn't stand watching what the Nazis were doing to the Jews. So he asked his government for permission to issue the Jewish people 6,000 visas so they could escape to Japan where the Nazis couldn't reach them. The Japanese were allies with the Nazis in those days. They turned down Mr. Sugihara's request. They denied him. And what did Mr. Sugihara do? He disobeyed the order of his government and issued those 6,000 visas anyway, because as he said it, that was the right thing to do. And he did that knowing full well what the consequences will be to him. Those 6,000 Jews obtained those visas, and I have a copy of one of those original visas. And those Jews went to Japan. They all survived the war in Japan. And the government of Japan fired him from his position in Lithuania and brought him back to Japan with his family. And he knew what will happen to him. And he lived in poverty and obscurity. Now Mr. Sugihara is a great humanitarian hero in Japan. And they built a beautiful statue in his honor. And the Japanese people in Little Tokyo in Los Angeles also built a statue in his honor. There was a man by the name Raoul Wallenberg, who was the Swedish ambassador to Hungary while Hungary was occupied by the Nazis. Mr. Wallenberg, he saved 100,000 Jews from the grips of the Nazis. They were just about to ship 100,000 Jews to the gas chambers, and he issued them Swedish visas that made them instantly Swedish citizens, and Hitler could not touch them. He saved 100,000 Jewish people from extermination.
That is absolutely amazing. I mean, how people can step up to the plate, risk their own lives, and there just goes to show there are good people, and when good people step up to the plate and speak up, speak out, do what is right, even if it risks their lives, 100,000 people could be saved, 1 million people, a whole nation could be saved, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And it's when people live in fear and they keep creating fear-mongering that people think they have to lose their freedom, their rights, and their liberties, for example, over a virus that will fade away eventually. And so this is where we have to be very careful and draw the line on which side we're on. Are we on the side of fear and tyranny? Are we on the side of the Constitution, freedom, liberty, and rights? In every country, people have to make a decision. And I just want to thank you so much. I'm so honored that you shared your story with us, Dr. Eisenbach, on Colombo Chronicles today. And I hope I talk to you again in the future. And I'm glad to know you're my neighbor. A little ways away there. And you keep up the great mission that you're doing, because this should never, ever be forgotten in my humble opinion.
Do I have just a few minutes more?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. In Bulgaria and Albania, small European countries, there are Jewish people living there. Albania was 90% Muslim and 10% Christians, and thousands of Jews. And when Albania was occupied by the Nazis, they were hiding the Jewish citizens, the Jewish neighbors, in such a way that the Nazis couldn't find a single one. Albania did the same thing. And in Poland, there were great Polish humanitarians who were hiding Jews in holes on the ground, risking their own lives. When the Nazis found out about it, they killed not only the Jews, but the Polish people as well. but that didn't stop them from continuing their humanitarian work. So by telling my audiences these stories, I end up by saying, how can I possibly lose faith in humanity when such great humanitarians were walking on the surface of this planet? Then I was asked the question, do I feel like having revenge? My answer to that question is that I live in the greatest country that ever existed. And I practice my favorite profession of dentistry, which I really enjoyed. And I had a wonderful family with three sons, the way at a sudden heart attack at the age of 51. And
sorry.
And I see the white and blue flag with the Star of David, which is the flag of the State of Israel, flying proudly. And those are the things that I enjoy, and this is my revenge. Also, I was asked if I feel like having revenge, and I tell the story that our Jewish tradition is teaching us that one of the greatest achievements of a human being is to turn an enemy into a friend. And that happened with the president of the state of Egypt, which was at war with Israel. And they saved the life of President Anwar Sadat. There was a plot to assassinate him. And Jewish intelligence workers found out about that plot, and they couldn't give that information to President Sadat, so they gave it to the King of Morocco. And the King of Morocco gave it to President Sadat. He arrested the plotters. He did whatever he needed to do, but it saved his life. And he decided he is going to make friends with Israel. He doesn't want to fight any more wars with Israel. And he became friends. And that peace treaty he signed with Israel 40 years ago is holding to this day. After that peace treaty was signed, my wife and I made a trip to Egypt. And the Egyptian people told me that they were supporting President Anwar Sadat to sign the peace treaty. And they do not want to fight any more wars. They want to live in peace. And I have a lot of respect for the Egyptian people. And I have made friends with a Muslim imam in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He has been a friend of the Jewish president of the synagogue for 8 years. And he and I are good friends. We had a great breakfast together.
Yes, I think and that, you know, people are so, if people don't elect the right people into office, well, some people can't, some countries, but people who can elect the right people into office, they really have to do their background check on, you know, on people. And if they are not the right fit, they really need to exercise their constitutional rights to remove anyone who is anti-American, anti-Israel, anti-anything that has to do with crimes against humanity or hate and so forth. Because the real people in the world, the average people, they just want to live, right? They just want to, have food on their table, have a roof over their head, some clothing and job and live their lives. And it's the leaders who are always creating turmoil, and their decisions can, like in World War II, can take millions and millions of lives and create much, much suffering, destroy property, architecture, books, art, religions, everything, and make certain people extinct. There are people that have actually lived on our planet and are now extinct, and because of wars. And so I just want to thank you so much for sharing all this information with our audience today, and they're going to treasure it, I'm sure. And I just want to say God bless you. And God bless the work you're doing. And, you know, I can't thank you enough. You're fantastic.
Thank you very much, Rose. And thank you so much for inviting me. It was a pleasure and an honor to be invited to your radio program.
Thank you, Dr. Eisenbach. And I look forward to your documentary. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. And Dr. Jacob Eisenbach has left the building. And what an honor to have Dr. Jacob Eisenbach, one of the very few survivors of the Holocaust, the genocide that happened 75 years ago. And so if you get an opportunity to watch his videos on YouTube, his lectures, or go to his website and watch for his documentary as well, or go to one of his lectures, you'll be blessed. And it's something that we can never, ever forget or ever, ever allow to happen again. On that note, I'm running a little late. I want to say God bless you. God bless America. May God keep his hand on America. And remember, injustices can happen to you, and they can happen to me. But together, we can make a positive difference. Remember that you are never alone when you tune in to Columbo Chronicles every Wednesday with our very special guests.
Rose Columbo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Columbo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Columbo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Columbo Chronicles.